British Public Radio. Money.
Hello and welcome to Money Talk, the monthly investing roundtable from The Motley Fool. I'm Owen Benelak, and with me in the studio today, you'll hear the familiar laconic twang of Nate Weishaar, our imported American who works on the Fool's Champion Shares Pro and Share Advisor services, as well as the northern gruff of Mark Rogers, our newest analyst here at The Motley Fool. And as anyone who was listening last month knows, he is the only one of us whose girlfriend is a Zumba fanatic.
Thanks, Owen.
I'm fascinated. When is Kim coming in, Mark? She's not coming in, Mark's, Mark's saying, he's saying no, she's not coming in. He's waiting for the video version of the podcast where Kim will be showing us some of her Zumba moves. Welcome back to the studio, guys.
Glad to be here.
Hey, Owen.
Not sure Mark's glad to be here.
Not anymore.
I'm glad to just be watching this.
The summer is officially over, and it was a hot one by our standards anyway, not from Nate's standards. One of the first things Nate said to me actually when he joined the office was that he was born in the desert.
Wow.
Yes, summer here just doesn't compare.
It's like a Clint Eastwood film.
I'm just imagining cactuses and all sorts.
He was in the kitchen and he said, I'm from the desert. Was it something like that? It was fabulous.
That's what it says on my business card.
Desert Wrangler. The stock market, however, has been perhaps a bit more desert-like, in fact, over the last few months, which I think is quite interesting because for all the talk of frothy shares, FTSE 100 is down, or was down on the three official summer months by nearly 3%, which I think is pretty surprising. And even the US S&P 500, it was only fractionally in the black for the same official three-month period.
Well, I mean, we need to have a little bit longer term perspective. I think both markets are still up over 15% for the year. So while they're taking a bit of a rest, it's still been a strong year.
Is the FTSE really up 15% for the year?
I think it's slightly below 14.8, 14.9.
Yeah, it's funny. I checked earlier, you know, from a valuation point of view, and you know, only 32% of FTSE 100 companies, and it's the same with the S&P roughly. Only about 32% are actually trading below 15 times earnings at the moment. So it's only a rough guide, but it's an interesting statistic.
Yeah, I think in my official role as office bull, I would have to say that with economies picking up around the world, you'd probably want to see a higher PE. So that's not necessarily bad news.
But that also includes a lot of the financials and the big oil companies in there, which are always going to be trading on low growth multiples. So like I say, there's some froth there, I think could be argued.
Yeah, well, certainly I know that we're always talking about froth, but I think a few more three-month periods of 0% and suddenly we're talking about a correction. So anyway, it's back to school for us, September. Mark's been shopping in M&S for some new trousers and for city workers have been returning from their villas and their mansions in Tuscany, at least that's what it says in The Guardian, only to find that the mighty Vodafone and Verizon deal has finally come to pass. So we'll look at this monster $130 billion deal and what it means for Vodafone shareholders. From there, we'll effortlessly segue to share buybacks versus dividends, because personally, the last thing I want to see Vodafone do with the money is to go and buy something. Let's give it back to shareholders. And then we'll change topic completely to consider how much we should let headlines such as those swirling around the conflict in Syria affect our investing. And then finally, we'll run through three companies that we've each got our eyes on. Guys, you know the drill by now, so should we crack on?
Let's do it.
Yeah, let's go.
Okay, so Vodafone and Verizon. Now, I've checked the archives because I, like everyone, have a certain behavioral bias. I can't remember what it's called, in hindsight bias, isn't it? In investing terms, where you always think you saw everything coming. I have checked, and I did write an article in March 2010 for The Motley Fool, pointing out the massive value hidden in plain sight of Vodafone's stake in Verizon. And you guys will probably confirm that I like to think I'm pretty good at investing, but I'm not so brilliant that I alone spotted this, what's now a £130 billion deal, before anyone else. I mean, everybody has been waiting for Verizon to buy Vodafone's stake in Verizon Wireless for as long as I can remember. So, Nate, why has it finally happened?
Well, I guess the planets have aligned. And Vodafone first got involved with, it wasn't Verizon at the time even, but in 1999, Vodafone got started in the U.S. mobile market.
Did you just say 1999?
I did say
this 1999. This podcast is 25 minutes long.
It'll be a quick history, I promise. Shortly after buying AirTouch, Vodafone teamed up with Atlantic Bell, who then quickly teamed up with GTE and created Verizon Communications. Verizon Communications obviously owns 55% of the joint venture, and they've kind of had a tough relationship ever since. Vodafone doesn't have a controlling stake, so it has no say on what the cash flows from that company can do, and the cash flows have been very attractive, so it's been an issue, and we've finally seen things come together, and both parties have reached terms that they find attractive, and it looks like this ill-fated relationship may be over.
I mean, Verizon had finally started paying out some dividends, didn't it?
They did at the end, yes.
They'd finished paying off their debt. And then was it the debt of Verizon Wireless, I guess?
Yeah.
Well, I suppose it's appropriate, given how long this saga has been running for, that the terms of the sale, or the deal, I should say, aren't exactly simple either. Nate, you've drawn the short straw, I'm afraid. Mm. Can you recap for us what Verizon has had to pay Vodafone to finally get control of this apparently prized asset?
You said 25 minutes, right? Well, we've got £38 billion in cash, £38.9 billion in Verizon shares, loan notes of $3.2 billion, which will mature over 8 to 11 years, and Verizon will assume $1.6 billion in liabilities from Vodafone, and Vodafone will receive a 23% stake in Vodafone Italy. There you have it. Simple as can be.
What could be easier? I think that's pretty amusing, to be honest, when you read them. I mean, it sounds a bit like Verizon and Vodafone, either a couple of mobsters who are carving up the west side of town and sort of saying, you know, you can have the pier, I'm having the pizza joints and the, you know, the casinos. Or at worst, they sound like a couple of school kids sort of swapping Power Rangers for a saucy issue of nuts and say, you know, you can have the one with Blondes Gone Wild, but I want the Power Ranger with the mega eye laser beam. I always wanted that Power Ranger. On a serious note, it reads a little bit like Vodafone kind of kept going back and saying, guys, we've almost got the deal. I know on Friday we said we were there, but can you throw in Vodafone Italy? Can we have a bit of that?
If that was the winning bid right there, I'd be shocked. I'm pretty sure Verizon is quite happy to turn its back on Vodafone Italy right now.
I mean, as you ran through those assets, my keen investing ear picked out that UK shareholders could potentially get Verizon shares from this deal as part of the whole laundry list of bits and bobs. Is the company going to do anything to make it easier for UK shareholders to deal with these sudden windfall of Verizon shares?
Yes, they've come up with a B share scheme, which will supposedly make things easier. It's a windfall for investment banks, but it's essentially you as a shareholder will be granted a newly created B share, and that share you will have the chance to elect to receive the shares and the cash, or you get to just have the share cashed out. So you would never touch the Verizon shares.
So if you were sort of, I guess, a strategic fund manager who wanted a stake in the American telecoms business, you would keep your Verizon shares because that's presumably why you...
Yeah, the scheme gives all shareholders supposedly the best of whatever world they want to live in.
Okay, well, luckily there is a big cash component and it's even a bit bigger for small shareholders. But that brings us to the question of how little Vodafone shareholders like me and you, Mark, how we can get our hands on that spoils of war. And would it be outrageously cynical of me to add before Vodafone can desperately fling that money, another trophy asset?
Right.
Perhaps it would be slightly outrageous, but as a long-term Vodafone shareholder or share watcher, certainly that is the fear. But Mark, there is a big chunk of cash in this deal. What options does management have for returning it to shareholders?
Sure. Well, in this particular case, it's going to be around 2/3 of the proceeds are going to be distributed to shareholders. But, you know, just speaking generally about this sort of case, the obvious option would be a straight special dividend in cash terms or a distribution of Verizon shares to shareholders. But other options could at times include a share buyback or even a tender offer for shares at a set price. So there are a few options.
Yeah, the problem is that no one route for these options ever pleases everyone. Dividends are great in theory. I know they're very popular on the Motley Fool's boards. You get hard cash, what's to argue with? But of course, a lot of people pay tax on dividends once they get into the higher tax bracket, unless you have your Vodafone shares in an ISA, of course, or a SIP. On the other hand, people are suspicious, Nate, of share buybacks. Oh, Mark, even. You're looking at me like you've got more to say on this. People are suspicious of share buybacks. Are you one of those people, Mark?
Well, less so me personally. I think some investors can misunderstand the purpose of share buybacks at times. I understand that many investors would prefer the hard cash in their hands, but at the same time, buybacks effectively give you as a shareholder a more concentrated, a larger stake in the business that you already own, which presumably you find attractive to begin with. And if the shares are undervalued and there aren't obvious reinvestment options for the cash within the business, then it could be at least a straightforward way of creating shareholder value. Now, on the other hand, it may not be a great sign as an investor if the company you're invested in does not have a more immediate use within the business for that cash. So you can look at it from a couple of different angles there.
The essential point about buybacks, which I think people struggle to get their heads around, is in an ideal world, is say, let's keep it easy. There's 1,000 shares of Mark Rogers pastry selling,
right.
Pasty selling, that's what they are, the old Greggs. Mark Rogers Enterprises, and you make £1,000 a year, and maybe theoretically each share has some economic attachment to that £1,000. And if you were to buy back 500 of those shares and you were to still make £1,000, then now earnings per share is doubled.
Right. So even if net income or real cash flow stays the same, if the share count goes down, you'll obviously attribute more of that as a shareholder as the buyback goes on.
Right. Well, obviously people are cynical. And Nate, you and I have both read William Thorndike's book, The Outsiders, which is all about unconventional CEOs who made really incredible returns for their shareholders by doing various, you know, at times strange things over the years. And a lot of those CEOs, I think probably all of them, often like to repurchase their shares at some point. I'd even say that some of them popularized buybacks. The key thing is they didn't tend to do it the day after announcing a £130 billion record-breaking deal when everyone was watching and the share price had sort of rallied 20% over the last few months, did they?
No, they used share buybacks as a very strategic tool. They knew the value of their company, and when they felt that the market didn't, they took advantage and they would buy undervalued shares, and the ones who did it best would buy a lot of undervalued shares. They would buy huge chunks of their company back from the market at the discounted prices, which was a great use of shareholder funds and provided great returns.
I mean, we see some companies doing that even today, don't we?
Every once in a while we do. The most recent that comes to mind is Apple, who raised their share buyback scheme from $10 billion to $60 billion in April because they felt that the shares were that undervalued and they have plenty of cash sitting around.
Yeah, I think that was when investors, perhaps not Apple fanboy shareholders, but investor shareholders really sort of, certainly I re-rated CEO Tim Cook a little bit there, because people were clamoring for him to do something like that when the shares were $700 each or just shy of it. And he did it when they were $400. So, you know, to Mark's point, if you buy back your shares with the aim of enhancing earnings and you're getting almost two shares for every one that you could have got at $700, so it's a much better use of cash.
Well, it's always better to buy cheap.
Exactly. Okay, well, the London market definitely got a lift from the Vodafone deal last week, not least because Vodafone is a huge chunk of the London market. It also rose, though, pretty sharply, seemingly in response to the delays to Western intervention in Syria. Now, it is always dubious to speculate about what moves the markets in the short term. We would all agree, I think. But it feels to me like the market has been wobbling a bit about the Syria crisis, and possibly at least a delay, if not any kind of certainty in any action, seems to have been taken as good news in the way that only our friends in the city shouting buy and hold can do. Presumably we'll revisit all again in a fortnight. But Nate, new investors, when they see these sorts of headlines and perhaps they read on bulletin boards or in newspapers that, you know, oil is going to be disrupted or there'll be terrorist reprisals or whatnot, you know, it can be hard not to think you have to do something, particularly if you then see your shares going down in value. But is there any mileage in the average investor kind of reading the newspapers and refreshing his BBC News web homepage and trading on the back of that?
Well, normally whenever I hear people say they're compelled to do something, I would argue that that's the worst time to do something. But especially when you're trading off the back of news as an average investor, you're probably at the losing end of that because many other people have access to the exact same news and they have better access to the markets. And so I think as an investor, if you see developments that truly threaten the long-term prospects of your company, then you do something about it. But jumping around from company to company on the back of headlines and the latest news stories, it's a tough way to come out ahead.
I think something that people always forget is that, okay, we've got a terrible situation now in Syria, but if you have investments that are exposed to Syria by whatever means, you know, it could be anything from pharmaceuticals to energy to airlines, you know, there could be some consequences, then you've got investments that are exposed to Egypt or South Korea or various other flashpoints around the world, and they just don't happen to be in the headlines today. So how do you get ahead of that?
It's something you've got to keep in mind when you're initially investing. You have to know the risks that your companies face and what markets they're exposed to and what types of things could trip them up. But a lot of companies are well enough diversified that a single event may hurt a single year's results or maybe a couple of years, but PZ Cousins isn't going to be undermined necessarily by disruptions in Nigeria. And you've got all sorts of companies that will be able to weather difficult situations.
I know that some people get kind of uncomfortable talking about investing in the light of this sort of potential human tragedy. If it already is a human tragedy, but I would have thought lobbing in a few nukes possibly would make it even worse. Mark, I'm guessing that you kind of have some positive news for anyone who doesn't kind of want to even think about the consequences, in that you're a long-term investor. You probably don't flip in and out the market on this kind of thing.
Well, listen, you know, any humanitarian crisis such as the one that's developing in Syria at the moment is nothing for us to make light of as investors. You know, we're responsible human beings, so we should think about the consequences of what's going on around the world. But I think, you know, as investors, it's deeply irrational to begin panic selling stakes in good businesses because of a period of turmoil. I think investors even have a human responsibility even to remain rational and strong in a time of crisis. And, you know, as we know, more often than not, selling in panic doesn't tend to lead to more profitable outcomes than holding on.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you. I remember I wrote about this a little bit in the Champion Shares Pro Memo, but I remember at the time of September 11th, which for all of us, I think, was a shocking few days. Nate probably had extra resonance for you. But that was an attack on capitalism, a specific attack on capitalism, effectively. And there were people arguing on the boards that it was kind of immoral to talk about consequences, but you can't just turn on and off the markets.
No, I think to turn your back and ignore a situation like that, I think that's irresponsible on a human level. And I think we're human beings as well as investors. We have rational decisions to make as investors. And from a business standpoint, and as well as if we can separate that from our feelings about, you know, what is going on in the rest of the world, then
But I would even say, even leaving aside the morality of, or the human empathy, perhaps is the best phrase,
right?
Does it make the world a better place if for a few days people panic and oil goes up $20? I don't think that does anyone any favors.
No, it obviously doesn't. And me panicking here in London and selling my shares doesn't solve anything in Syria or wherever. And actually, what generally solves these bigger issues is the resumption of normal activity. And that requires markets to work.
Absolutely. Well, my glamorous assistant has come around. She's called Kim. And she...
Really, Owen?
He's given me the secret sealed envelopes, which contain the shares that we'll be looking at this month, I should say. And none of them are involved, as far as I can see, with Syria. There may be some connections, but I think that we are pretty safe discussing these with Syria independent investments. So, Mark, let's start with the company that you've got your eye on.
I'm going to talk about BSkyB today. So Sky just has this remarkable share of mind when it comes to premium content. You couldn't imagine Liverpool versus United or Transfer Deadline Day or the Ashes without Sky Sports covering it live. It's almost like an adult form of Disney, that kind of association with these events. And on top of that, I think because of its scale, Sky is really the only company in the UK that can make those sort of high content costs for Premier League content, etc., work economically. And they achieve these remarkable returns and margins, even in spite of those high costs. So one thing that I really do like about Sky is the real pricing power that it can generate from its subscriber base. I think just remarkably sticky. I mean, they're retaining something like 90% of their customers each year, and they're charging £600 a year for this premium service. So I think it's a great business, and I think it's worth a lot more than $13 billion.
I think it's a good time to talk about it for sure, with football kicking off for the next 50 weeks. Looks like the 2-week holiday was over. But I have noticed that this kind of area, perhaps more so in the US at the moment, but we've seen a glimmer of it here, is getting more competitive. Content providers, which is effectively what the Premier League is. I mean, the Premier League has never been shy about making money. Let's not make any odds about that. But nevertheless, I think content providers have kind of wised up to the value that they have. We're seeing more competition from alternative distribution channels, effectively. So we've seen BT, for instance, now has a sports offering. How can you be confident the lock that Sky undoubtedly has and has had for, you know, at least a decade is going to kind of persist in a more competitive world?
I certainly don't think you can ignore that. And it's absolutely a risk that you have to consider when you're looking at any company like Sky, when it's in a dominant position like it is today, because it's achieving these great margins, these great returns. But you know, that's always going to be under threat, and it always has been under threat. But I think you have to remember that given the high bidding costs for content, Sky is probably one of the only companies in the UK that could make that work on a traditional way. And of course, there'll be alternatives, things like Netflix, etc., coming along. And you also have to remember that with the relationships that have been cultivated over the years between Sky and the Premier League, the two have gotten rich together, and it's
I'm probably a bit more cynical. I guess I just kind of think all that cash that's undoubtedly flowed through Sky, anyone who is in the Premier League is going to look at that cash. And just like we saw in the pro investment we had a few years ago with Wiseman Dairies, it seems completely different. But suddenly they were making kind of much better margins, and Tesco screwed down their prices.
The league has become as lucrative as it has in large part because of Sky putting that money in there to work there. It makes sense economically for Sky to do that, because obviously they've got 10 million plus subscribers and they all want to watch Premier League football. It's a great share of mine to have as well.
Nate, yes. What are you watching at the moment and why?
Well, I'm not watching the Premier League.
Plenty of time.
Yeah.
To catch the other 78 games.
Actually, a company that's caught my eye is ABB. It's a Swiss manufacturer of a various range of electronic equipment. They specialize in transmission of electricity as well as more exciting end of robots. So their whole company focus is on increasing efficiency, essentially efficient use of scarce resources and efficiency in the manufacturing process.
I'm starting to think that when they send back the Terminator from the future, he's going to go, show me Nate Weishaar, because you are obsessed with robots.
Well, I am. It's true. But I also think that...
You don't mind the robot future as long as you own some of it.
That's true.
He'll be in the desert. He'll be fine.
Yeah. Robots don't like the desert.
There's no rust in the desert. Mark, do you have something sensible to ask me?
Yeah, I want to ask, you know, it sounds like the kind of business that would be relatively capital intensive. Am I right in thinking that?
Yes, it is. ABB not only has to spend for the manufacturing of the equipment they sell, but also they spend a lot of money researching and innovating to keep at the top end of their field. And there is a lot of investment required to maintain outperformance, but the company gets solid returns on that investment. And they've proven to be the leader in a lot of their fields. And I've actually seen Siemens off from the renewables energy sector because they performed better.
Yeah, I think that could be a real upside for them, given, not that I know anything about the company, but I was reading about Siemens and they were running back, the new management there, running in the other direction from green technology. It's been a bit of a day bark. It's kind of attempt to make green Siemens.
Yeah, they've had several missteps that have really cost them. And ABB has been on the same learning curve as Siemens, but has performed better to date.
Okay, well, we've almost got to the end of the podcast and the astute out there will notice we haven't mentioned a bank. I'm here to put that right. I'm going to mention Lloyds. I do own the shares, as some of you have probably grown tired of hearing on these podcasts. But the reason I'm talking about Lloyds this particular month is not because I think that they're a particularly great investment at the moment, they may or may not be, but because the government is likely, by all accounts, to finally sell some of its stake this month. The shares are, you know, nicely above 70 pence, nicely above where the government breaks even. Probably there will be those who say the government could make more money by hanging on. I don't disagree, but equally, if you are a large, large, large shareholder, even if you're a large shareholder in a small cap, you can't just go to the market one day with all your shares. It makes sense to sort of phase out your investment. So I think it will be good for the banking sector. I think it's a good time to do it. I think the UK economy is likely picking up. Housing's definitely off to the races, I think is the technical term. Hopefully they can get rid of the shares before it sort of, you know, someone hits a fence or breaks a leg or whatever the racing parlance is. So yeah, I think it's going to be an interesting 2 months for Lloyds and I'm going to very closely keep my eyes on that. And in fact, I would say even if the shares had a sort of massive spike, I would possibly even sell some of my beloved Lloyds shares.
Oh my.
I did sell some. I sold some of my stake, patting myself on the back at about 60 pence, which obviously is 25% lower than where they are now. Well, not exactly, but from the profit I forgave up or whatever the phrase is. Nate, what do you think of Lloyds at this point?
I am always happy to see a government getting out of a publicly traded company. So if that's what this share price means, then I'm all for it. I'm still not completely sold on the long-term prospects of Lloyds, just because I think the banking sector is getting incredibly more competitive. But I must say that when you bravely stepped into the breach, it was looking very cheap. Today, not so much to me, but
no, I'd agree with that. And, you know, there's always a bit of fortune in investing. I have taken, as you know, toehold in some other crazier European banks. And it is a reminder of what Lloyds once looked like. And really how quickly things can change, I think, for banks. The UK did go back into recession. I don't think people would be clamoring for Lloyds shares.
No, but I still think the government should get out when they can.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, well, I think that's it for this week. Mark, did you have anything on Lloyds?
No, that's good.
Cool. We will be back next month where we'll be thick in the September. September's a bad month for the markets, apparently, statistically.
So I've heard.
We don't care about that, do we? Well,
buying opportunities.
Silly stats. All right, thanks, guys. See you next month.
See you guys.
See ya.